Hello and welcome back to the Chris Yeh podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh, and I am so delighted to be joined today by a very talented special guest, my friend, author, thinker, all-around guru, incredible woman, Whitney Johnson. Whitney, thank you for coming on today.
Oh, Chris, thank you for having me.
Now, we have our ulterior motives for doing this podcast because Whitney has a fantastic new book out called Smart Growth that we're going to talk about later on. And I just want to remind everyone, you may want to get a head start on ordering Smart Growth, which you can find at bookstores anywhere and everywhere. Is there any particular place that they would buy the book that would be most helpful to you, Whitney?
What a great question. I'd say either at a local bookstore, so you can support your local bookstores, or on Amazon. Both great places.
Wonderful. And of course, we'll talk more in depth about the book because I am very excited about it. And I think that there's stuff we can do together on the book as well, which is always something I look forward to. But I want to give people a sense of you because you have led a very interesting and unusual life. Your path is not just the kind of classic straight line path that we often see. And so I'd love to walk through some of the exciting parts of your life, starting with the fact that you were born in Madrid, Spain.
Yes, I was. And I really, first of all, appreciate you saying that I have lived an exciting life because I often look at other people's lives and think they're exciting and mine is so very dull. So I think that's a fascinating observation. I was born in Madrid, Spain. It turns out that my parents had just gotten married. They were living over there for a few months. And so I happened to be born there. But what's interesting is that when you're born somewhere, even if you don't stay for very long, we left when I was 6 months old, it has always been a place that has been a part of my identity. So I always studied Spanish in school and I went on a mission to Uruguay and I worked in investment banking and emerging markets. So this almost happenstance place of birth has defined very much who I am. And yes, I do speak Spanish. So that's where I was born. I grew up in San Jose, California. For those of you who know the Bay Area, I grew up in Almaden. I went to Leland High School. And when I went to college, I actually studied music. I have a Bachelor of Arts in Music and studied piano. But when I graduated from college, I had gotten married. My husband and I went to New York. He was getting his PhD at Columbia in microbiology. Someone needed to put food on the table, and I was that designated breadwinner. I had to go out and get a job. I did not want to do music. It was the late 80s. I was a woman. I was a music major. I had very little confidence. So my very first job was as a secretary to a stockbroker. If you've ever seen Working Girl, that was pretty much me.
Wow.
So I go to work every day, and I am sitting across from this bullpen of young stockbrokers, mostly men. They're saying things like, throw down your pom-poms and get in the game. And at first I'm very offended because I was a cheerleader at Leland High School, but I hear this over and over again and realize I need to throw down my pom-poms. So I start taking business classes at night, accounting, finance, economics. I had a boss who believed in me, who promoted me from being a secretary to an investment banker. And that set me on a completely different trajectory. And I would not have known to call it this then, but that was the first time I was disrupting myself. I was disrupting my mindset. Investment banker for several years. I have a boss who gets fired. They probably would have fired me too, except that at the time I was pregnant and I had good performance reviews, job security. So they shoved me into equity research. Equity research, at that time anyway, was like going from flying a fighter plane to a cargo jet. My ego took a huge hit, but equity research turned out to be a career maker. I was a good stock picker, good at building the financial models, good at spotting momentum. I did that for about 8 years, was institutional investor ranked. And then I discovered Clayton Christensen's work, The Innovator's Dilemma. This is 2003, 2004. It helps me understand what's going on in the emerging markets. Wireless is disrupting wireline. So I have this explanatory mechanism of, oh, that's what's happening. But it was even more seminal than that, because I realized that disruption wasn't just about products and services and companies and countries. It was about people. And that came into relief when I went to a boss and said, hey, I want to do something different. And they said, we like you right where you are. And I had this kernel of an idea that disruption could also be about people. And so within about a year, I disrupted myself. Became an entrepreneur, did that for several years. I think in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to work with clay, because when I left Wall Street, I did not take my financial models with me. I basically burned the bridges, burned the boats.
Slightly different.
Mixing up my metaphors. I burned the boats. And a few years later, I had been working with Clayton on a number of church-related projects, public affairs in the greater Boston area. He wanted to start a fund because people had been saying to him, hey, you know, you could use this framework for stock picking. You could go long Netflix, short Blockbuster. He starts a fund. His son is just now getting out of business school. I'd worked on Wall Street. And so I started a fund with him and his son, which I did for about 5 years. But then in 2012, something happened. There was this pattern taking place, because when I worked on Wall Street, I discovered that I was actually more interested in the momentum of people than stocks. I'm now applying the theory of disruption, not to products, but to people. And then I discovered the S curve of learning, or not, excuse me, the S curve, and realized, oh, we can apply that to people. And so I disrupted myself. I wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review called Disrupt Yourself, and started where I am today, which is basically, I started as a speaker, but have now built a business around this intellectual property of how do you grow your people to grow your company? And then we wrap coaching and workshops around that. But that's the trajectory. And I hope it was only 4 or 5 minutes.
Well, I don't actually know how long it took, but it was pretty fascinating for me because, again, there's these various intersections. As you know, we have clay in common as someone we knew. I was at Harvard Business School, class of 2000, so from 1998 to 2000, and I spent a decent amount of time with Clay, who is just an incredible human being, right? A wonderful, warm person, in addition to being one of the most brilliant management thinkers of the past 50 years. And obviously, I'm sure you still miss him. I miss him. It's a great tragedy. He was taken from us too early. But his notion of the innovator's dilemma and of disruption is the thing that has powered the startup world ever since he came up with it. I mean, this is literally the seminal work of the past 50 years or so. Mm-hmm. And you had a chance to be a part of it. And then you found a way to take it and apply it to human beings and individuals. And I see in that this grand sort of trajectory where you began in the liberal arts, you began in the realm of emotion and feeling and things like that, and personal meaning making, and you took this detour into finance and using the disruptive framework to make money, but you eventually came back around to actually this is all about personal growth and how we as individuals are going to be able to grow. And I just find that fascinating.
I love how you framed that, Chris. What a gift you just gave me. It's so interesting to tell your story and then to have someone repeat it back to you, mm-hmm. but to frame it slightly differently and show you to yourself. And that's really, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Well, as you know, we get something out of it every time we talk, which is why I'm so glad we could do this today. And I can tell you that, you know, this is a great time to start talking a little bit about Smart Growth, your latest book, because I picked it up, I started reading it, and when we started talking about the S-curves, of course, S-curves are something that, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about as well. We talk about the S-curve as part of blitzscaling, right? Because in blitzscaling, as you go up the steep part of the S, that's the blitzscaling element, but it's an S. It's not just an up and to the right forever. And there is always a time when you have to transition. And so companies like an Apple or a Google have to be able to add additional S's in order to keep growing, right? You can't just ride the same thing forever. But the same thing, and again, this is to your credit, your whole insight is, you know, this applies to people as well as companies and industries. And that really harkens back to my previous book, The Alliance, where we talk about people having a tour of duty. And, you know, we always talk about when's the right time to end the tour of duty and what is the project. But really, it ties in with your notion of the personal S-curve. Mm-hmm. Because each tour of duty, each thing you do in your professional career is that S-curve. And that's why it's so important that there be a way for employers and employees, managers and employees to have, you know, longer tenures, right? We talk about Free Agent Nation. Our other mutual friend, Dan Pink, coined that term way back in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. But the problem with people jumping jobs every 6 months is they're on the lower portion of the S curve. They're not in that beautiful up and to the right exponential growth area. You have to stick around long enough for that exponential growth, but then you have to find that next S if you want to keep growing. And it just feels like, yeah, we should talk about that. I feel like the combination of smart growth and the alliance would be an article that we should put together.
That would be so much fun. I would love that. And it's like if smart growth and the alliance had a baby, what would it be?
Exactly. I mean, heck, we can talk to our editors at HBR and get them excited. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I need to talk to them about something else anyways. My goodness, this is something we should get on the calendar.
Yeah, I think it would be a lot of fun to collaborate.
So talk to me about smart growth. What led you to say, okay, you know what? I want to write another book, because you know, we're authors. We know it's a long, hard slog. Mm-hmm. And one of the dirty little secrets is that writing books is one of the hardest things in an author's life. And it's why so many of us put it off for so long. I mean, we have 4 years passed between the Alliance and Blitzscaling, and I'm not sure exactly when the next book is going to come out because so many other things came up. What made you decide now was the time to write a new book?
So I had written Disrupt Yourself. I then wrote Build an A-Team, and both of those books. So Disrupt Yourself was about personal disruption. Build an A-Team was how do you take these ideas and apply them to building a team? Because disruption isn't just about career change. It's about using this as a mechanism to build a team and allowing people to jump to new curves. But one of the things that happened is that in both of those books, the S-curve of learning was always in the background. And I wasn't very focused on it, but people, as they started to reflect back to me, like you just did, I remember I went on Dan Pink's Pink Cast about 3 years ago, and he said, well, what do you want to talk about? And he'd gone through the book, and I said, what about this? What about this? What about this? And he finally said, that. Let's talk about the S curve of learning. And when I had people coming back to me, reflecting back to me, I realized, oh, this is something that is very useful for people. It's simple, it's visual, and because it's so simple, it's useful. And so I thought, I need to just do a deeper dive on this. It needs to be not the supporting actor, the leading actor, and put all of my energy and capacity into thinking about how can I make this as simple as possible for people to think about what growth looks and feels like.
Yeah. And Dan, of course, is a master of being able to find the nugget, find the thing that really just grabs people. I often say about books that the most important thing is that every book can be summarized with one big idea. Mm-hmm. Right? Books have multiple ideas, but everyone ends up thinking of one idea coming out of the book. So for Lean Startup, it's minimum viable product. For The Hard Thing About Hard Things, it's like wartime CEO, peacetime CEO, and so on and so forth. And I think it's so smart to have a book that is tightly focused around that big idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is what growth looks and feels like. Here's your emotional arc. Absolutely.
And part of it is also, and I think that this is really important, as you put it, the emotional arc, right? This is, again, coming full circle, Wall Street and music and English and everything else. The emotional arc is a huge part of what we have to manage, right? It's not just a question of, oh, we're going to go out and get these skills. We're going to practice these things. It's how do we manage our own emotions as we're going through this process?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that someone said to me not too long ago, he said, Whitney, it's interesting. You make these vast intuitive leaps and then you figure out how to find, you know, to substantiate them. And so one of the things that was important for me in this book was to be able to substantiate what my hunch said was in fact correct. And so I looked at, you know, biology, and I looked at lots and lots of anecdotal qualitative experiences, but also wanted to look at neuroscience. And so the reason I say it's a dopamine management exercise is that whenever you start something new, you're at the launch point of a curve, because your brain's making all these predictions, many of which are wrong, your dopamine is dropping. And so it makes it very hard to start something new. But when you know it's going to be hard neurologically, that makes it easier to persist. And then when you get into the sweet spot, because you are making predictions and they're increasingly accurate, but you're oftentimes surprised at how accurate they are, you're getting these emotional upside surprises, lots and lots of dopamine. So that's why it's exhilarating and it's fun to be in the sweet spot. And so growth not only is fast, it feels fast. So at the launch point, it feels slow. In the sweet spot, it feels fast. And then mastery, what's interesting, so interesting, intriguing to me about mastery is at this point, you've figured out the model. You know exactly what you're doing, but it's like playing a middle C. It's like playing a C major chord. Ultimately, it's not very interesting. You're not getting very much dopamine at this point. And that's why so often you hear people say, I was really good at it, but I couldn't keep doing it. It's because you needed more dopamine. And so when you understand emotionally what's happening, where you're going to feel overwhelmed, exhilarated, underwhelmed, you understand that growth cycle. It allows you to manage the growth and normalize the feelings that you're having at different points along your growth cycle.
And this is one of the things that I am constantly telling people in terms of advice, which is the importance of metacognition. What you're really talking about is metacognition, which is taking a step back from the way your brain is working and the way you're feeling and saying, well, what's the broader context? And how can I appropriately set my expectations around these things? And I can't help, because we're authors, applying it to the process of writing a new book, right? You start off at the very beginning and you're gathering the stuff. You don't know exactly if it's going to work or not. And there's a lot of uncertainty. And then you sort of pick up momentum and you're going through and the words are flowing out at various times, like, oh, this story or this principle, and this is so exciting. And then you get to the end and you're editing over and over and over again. And yeah, you know what you're saying, but it starts to make you sick of just your own words. And this is like a microcosm for the process that you're talking about.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. You get to the point where, and in fact, you know, one of my editors and writers, she'll say to me sometimes, Whitney, if I have to write another, you know, article on this particular idea, I think I'm going to retch. I don't think she says that. Well, maybe she does. I'm being dramatic. But you do, you get to the top of an S curve and you say, this isn't interesting to me anymore. I need to do something that surprises and delights me. I need more dopamine. And so you start a new book and you go back down to the launch point and you have all of those feelings that come of overwhelm and insecurity, because your identity, you have to deal with identity shifts. Mm-hmm. And it's really uncomfortable. And sometimes, and I actually want to say this because I think this is important.
Whoops. Wow. What was that?
That was lots of things falling off my shelf because I've got a cat, but it was really trying to underscore what I just said.
Well, we're leaving that in. I'm not editing that out. That's perfect.
I think you totally should. So you're in this. So what I wanted to say is sometimes at the launch point, because you've got such an open loop and it's so uncomfortable that we try to rush through it.
Mm.
We just try to rush through it. And that is where we make mistakes. I just want to get this product to market. I just want to get this piece published. I just want to have this conversation. And we need to take that time to explore and collect, which I talk about at the launch point, so that we make sure we're actually on the S curve that is the appropriate S curve for us at this time.
You know, I'm going to recommend Smart Growth to a woman I just talked to this morning who is a fellow Harvard Business School alum, enormously accomplished woman. And she is at that point in her life right now where she's exploring, right? That's the whole phase, the explorer mm-hmm. phase. She's thinking about things. And it's one of the things where in some ways she's been the victim of success. When she left, when she graduated HBS, mm-hmm. She was going to join BCG and she had like a 6-month period between her graduation date and her start date. And so she started helping this startup and then 6 months went by and it ended up, she's like, well, I can't leave this startup. She uh-huh. told her husband, I'm not going to go to BCG. He's like, yeah, I know. And she helped build this startup as a co-founder and they sold it for hundreds of millions of dollars, huge success. Very first thing in her career. But then, you know, she jumped into other things very quickly. She jumped past that uncertainty and mm-hmm. those other enterprises weren't necessarily as successful. And I think part of it was, wow, you know, I got this huge dopamine hit. I built this great company. I was able to sell it. I was able to make a huge amount of money. And these are all fantastic. And I don't want to get back to that. And she didn't spend enough of the time in that uncertain phase where you're not sure if the things you're doing are going to work out. You're not sure if you're wasting your time. We don't like that feeling. And yet it's necessary.
Right. The price of the sweet spot is the launch point.
Yeah. That is so important. Now, how long should people spend during that period? Like, let's say we're talking to someone who's one of our friends, they're brilliant and accomplished and all those things. And they're thinking, I want to try something new. How long should they spend at the launch point? Because, you know, if they spent 5 years at the launch point, I feel like, well, that's way too long. Like, what are the rule of thumb there?
I agree. I think if you're at 5 years at the launch point, it's probably the wrong S curve for you. And you are just beating your head against the wall. If you map against Erickson's 10,000 hour rule, you would be at the launch point for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And qualitatively, that rings pretty true, is that you start a new job and you initially go home every night or go downstairs today and say, oh, I thought this was a great idea, but now I'm not so sure. Because not only do you not necessarily have the skills you need yet to do the job, but you don't know where everybody is and you don't know how to get buy-in for your job. And you just... there's all this growth is happening. That's what's interesting about the launch point. It's not that growth isn't happening. If you look at growth like in a sort of a lily pad pond, the growth is actually really, really fast at the launch point. It's just that you can't see it because all the tubers are still down in the water, in the muck and the mud, and they haven't come up yet. And so that's, but generally it's, you can use as a rule of thumb 6 months. If you're doing something for more than 6 months and you don't feel like you're gaining momentum, it's a pretty good sign that you need to tweak your S curve a little bit.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, again, I can selfishly do this because it's my podcast, but, you know, in terms of my own experience, I mean, part of it as well with that launch point is I try to choose things where I find them inherently interesting, where mm-hmm. spending time in that uncertainty and not knowing if it's going to work or not, I can tell myself, well, if it doesn't work out, that's okay, because I wanted to learn more about this. I wanted to try this out. And there is value just in the trying, even if there's no success.
Yeah. You know what? I love that idea. In fact, you just made me think of something, because I'm in the launch point on something right now, and I might be in the launch point for a really long time. But one of the gifts of COVID was my daughter persuaded me to watch K-dramas, and I watched one, and now I don't even know how many we've watched, and we just are absolutely obsessed with them, or at least I am. Everybody else goes along. But I thought, you know what? I want to learn a little bit of Korean, because like, why not? And so I have this app. I'm on Duolingo, and I'm now in 70 days of doing 5 minutes a day.
Wow.
That is not going to get me fluent, but it's enjoyable. And I'm okay being at the launch point, perhaps perpetually, but maybe not, right? Because that's what happens. It's slow. And then one day it's fast if I persist.
Absolutely. And if it doesn't ever happen, it's still something that you were willing to invest the time in, because the journey itself is some of the reward. My daughter also started watching these K-dramas. I always say my daughter, she's 17, she's a senior in high school. So it's like she's the canary in the coal mine for all these new trends. I learn about the trends and the lingo and everything like that by observing her. It's going to be very bad for my investing when she goes off to college, because then I won't be able to see it firsthand every day. But, you know, I think that the first K-drama, the sort of gateway drug, you may have seen this one. I think it's called something like Crashing Into You.
Oh, yes. Crash Landing on You. Yes.
Crash Landing on You.
Yes, that is. We have watched that one. Our gateway one, and she's probably seen this one too, is called Romance is a Bonus Book. That was my first drama that we watched. So your daughter and I may want to compare notes, because we love them.
Absolutely. This is the thing about the pandemic. I mean, we talked about it as a group, the Silicon Guild, which is the, of course, the not so secret society of best-selling authors that we belong to. And we talked about this at the beginning of the pandemic, which is, you know, we have to reframe this pandemic as opportunity, not just as tragedy. If we just frame it as a tragedy, of course, it'll be a tragedy. None of us wanted this. Mm-hmm. But given what's happening, you know, let's get into K-drama. Let's learn Korean. Let's create a venture fund, right? And whatever the pandemic project is, let's do it. And I think that, you know, of course, we're all getting a little tired of it. But nonetheless, it's much better to look back and say, this is what I have to show for it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I was just talking to a colleague, Gian Piero Petriglieri, and he said, I would love for us to come out of the pandemic thinking more expansively and not diminishing ourselves. And I've also thought about this is, and you know this, Chris, is that psychologists have said that after a period of tremendous stress, like a pandemic, there's often significant growth, and it's called post-traumatic growth. And so one of the things I've thought a lot about over the past couple of months is this idea of people keep talking about their resigning, the great resignation. And if you think about this in the context of an S-curve of learning, people aren't actually resigning, they're aspiring. And so for me, it's the great aspiration of people are saying, I'm not giving up. I'm aspiring to more. Like I just climbed this really hard mountain called the pandemic. And now I can see a lot more than I could. And I want another mountain. And I don't want to go back to doing the exact same thing I was doing before because I'm a different person.
I love that. That's a great way. I'm going to start talking about it like that because, of course, this topic is all over the place and people are always asking me about it. And based on what you just said, I'm going to say, listen, the key thing to this great resignation, the first thing I've always said is, well, it's not really a true great resignation in the sense that these people are going somewhere. You're talking about young people quitting their jobs. I don't think they're retiring unless they're Bitcoin billionaires. So guess what? They're going somewhere. But the part that you've added, the insight that you just gave me is that, you know, the moves, the great resignation is not a move born out of desperation. It's a move born out of aspiration. That's going to be my new catchphrase about this.
Yeah. And I think not only do I believe it's true, yes, some people are tired and they're burned out, which I think is a different thing and they just need to take a break. But I think it also honors us and humanity in an important way of not saying that we're giving up because we're not giving up. I think we discovered how resilient we are. And so I think it's important to frame it in a way of saying, actually, we just want more.
Absolutely. And we've talked about this many times, right? As a group and the Silicon Guild and even you and I together, which is that the story that we tell ourselves, the way we frame the events of our lives is how we create meaning, right? The events, once they happen, cannot be changed. Mm-hmm. But the way they fit into our story, that's our choice.
Yeah, so powerful. And Chris, I think that's something actually I've been flirting with. And now that you're saying it, you reminded me that I want to go back and flirt with it some more, because I do think that as you think about your life, there are things that happen, you know, that don't work out the way you want and don't go well. And we all have our whole host of an array of failures. And as we become more aware, and as you talked about metacognition, how are we using that ability to frame everything that happened to us in a way that it contributed to our growth? Because there actually, growth isn't possible without something that prevents our growth.
That's right. And in overcoming growth, just like in exercise, right? As somebody lifts weights or sprints or what have you, the micro tears of the muscle fibers, which then come back stronger, is the mechanism for gaining strength. Now I also, selfishly, there is something that I had on my mind. I wanted to run it past you because, as you can tell, for those of you who are listening, when we have these conversations, Whitney just fills me with different insights. So I just love it. One of the other thoughts is on the mastery side. So, you know, as you mentioned, we're both authors, which means that a lot of what we do is give talks, speaking engagements. It's one of the ways that we make money. And part of it is when you're giving a speaking engagement, it is absolutely the case that you could end up giving the same talk. And I remember our mutual friend, Franz Johansson, telling me about how he had met a very famous author, very famous speaker, early in his career as a speaker, because they were speaking at the same event. And he discovered that this very famous author, one of the most famous of all time, had become an alcoholic, right? After each event, he would just start drinking. And it's because he just felt like he was a robot, just wheeled out to say the same thing over and over and over again. That's that lack of dopamine on the mastery side. And he started to medicate himself with alcohol. And France was like, wow. I was like, well, I never want that to happen to me. And, you know, now that was before I ever had written a book. Now that I've written a book and I give talks all the time and I speak about blitzscaling all the time, for me, I'm covering much of the same material, but I would say there's two things that I do that I think help me overcome the sort of dopamine issue around mastery. Mm-hmm. The first is that I am always very focused on making what I'd say and the way I speak about things interactive. So I have to not just work off of a script, but actually look at the inputs that are coming in from the audience. I usually use a chat room for Zoom, or I use people raising their hands in person. And even though I'm using many of the same jokes and many of the different same things over and over again, I'm actually, you know, have to adjust and adapt. So I actually have to pay attention. I can't just operate on autopilot. And the other is I make sure that I leave time at the end for questions and answers. And if they don't want Q&A, I always tell them, I really think you should do Q&A. And that's because the questions may be unexpected. Sometimes they're questions you've gotten before. There are certain questions I just know I'm always going to get asked. So how did you and Reed meet? Because, of course, my co-author Reed Hoffman is a very famous guy, and people want to know, like, how do you know this magical figure? But then there are new questions every time, and specific questions. And I think that the ability to answer the audience's questions so it's obvious that they're not just reciting a set of formulas is a big part of what makes it exciting. So I'm curious what your reactions are to that.
Well, first of all, that story that you just told about the person that became an alcoholic, that is very sobering.
Not a member of our guild. Let me emphasize that.
Yeah. I think it's sad, but it's also very illustrative of the importance of continuing to challenge ourselves. And yeah. I also do think there is something that happens, and this may have contributed to it as well, is that when you finish, at least for me, when I finish a speech, I feel very vulnerable because I have just been on stage. I have given everything that I possibly have to this audience. And you just don't know quite how it's been received. And you've got to have a real ability to internally validate regardless of what happens. And so I suspect there was some element of that for this individual as well. I think the dopamine is there as well. So but anyway, that story really struck me. So thank you for sharing that. In terms of you're interacting with the audience, that absolutely, it's such a wild card as you're speaking. And I would argue that some of the best speeches that I've given, and I think this is probably true for you, is in that moment where you know your material so well that you do feel like kind of a stand-up comic, and something happens and you're able to laugh with people and make jokes and everybody there. It's like a piece of music. You're all just in that together. And that is a really magical moment. And that absolutely gives dopamine. So what I think is interesting too, I'm not quite answering your question, but also I think it's interesting that you do Q&A at the end, because I actually like to do Q&A prior to the end, because I like to have that interaction. So you get that dopamine, but then bring everybody back to that moment of feeling some sense of inspiration. And so I'm curious why you decide to do it, the Q&A at the end.
So that is an interesting question. I think it's because the Q&A, in most cases, the audience is really involved. And so it will last an indefinite period of time. And we almost always have to cut it off. Like, not everyone gets their questions answered. Mm-hmm. And so I put it at the end so that there is, you know, the flexibility to extend it if need be. So I think that's probably the main reason. But then, you know, something about what you said, I want to draw it back. This is, I studied improvisational comedy when I was at Stanford. So we're very big on reincorporation, or what the stand-up comedians call the callback. So it's returning to the same themes over and over again. But I feel like when you're talking about interactivity with the audience, creating that synchronicity with the audience, which also generates dopamine, even if you're covering similar material, that comes back around to your education as a musician, right? Mm-hmm. You're playing a piece on the piano, a great concerto or something like that. And you're not improvising. I mean, I don't know, maybe you were a jazz pianist, but if you're a classical pianist, you're not supposed to improvise.
Right.
But you are, you know, changing slightly the timing, changing slightly the emphasis. And if you're able to create that synchronicity with the audience as you're performing the piece, that's the thing that's so emotionally satisfying, the piece itself and the mastery, but then the synchronicity with the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And in fact, I remember one time, one of my best speeches after I finished, I had someone come up to me and he said, it was like you were playing an instrument. And he didn't know I was a musician. And that was the best compliment. I'll never forget that compliment. Now back to your dopamine question.
Yes.
So I think what I'm finding, I really love those observations of yours. I'm finding that it helps me as I look to incorporate new stories, new material. And, but that also means that it pushes me back down to the launch point. Not too long ago, I gave a speech and I was like, it was a webinar. I was like, oh, that was not great. And I was, you know, talking to my husband and he's like, well, Whitney, it's a new speech launch point. It's going to be clunky. And I just, I just didn't want to be there. Right. I just did not want to be there. But that's how you keep it fresh, is that willingness to go do new material and know it's going to be bad a few times, but oh, it's painful. But here's the beauty of it, Chris. I did one and I was like, oh, that wasn't good. And I thought maybe it's just an anomaly. But then I did another one that was kind of clunky. And here's the good news, is that's when you start to dig deep and you're like, okay, this is a call for me. This means I can now grow, because I am in this place that's uncomfortable. And if I will really research this and think about this, then I'm going to have a step up and I'm going to become an even better speaker, which I think we all aspire to, because we speak, because you can communicate your information in lots of different ways. But one of the beauties of public speaking is that if you do it right, you do it well, you have this moment where people feel truly inspired.
Yes. It's a great, great feeling. And I love the fact that what you just said is a classic illustration of the growth mindset. It's like, oh, now that I've established the pattern that there's something that needs to be fixed, now I can really dig in. Now I can really learn. As opposed to, oh man, that sucked. And the second time it didn't work, I should just give up. You're like, no, I'm digging in. I'm going to make this work. And the other thing, the other insight, which just came to me as you were speaking about the launch point is, and stand-up comedy and other things like that, improv is uniquely an exercise of getting comfortable at the launch point. Because it is always starting from a position of the unknown and the uncertain with no preparation. And, you know, I often talk about the importance of my improv training in my career. And this gives me a much better way of describing it, because, you know, normally I talk about it and therefore I feel very comfortable improvising and making changes on the fly. And that's why it works very well in the startup world. But the framework of it gives you extended exposure to the launch point, getting comfortable with the uncertainty, getting comfortable with the, is this going to work or not, to the point where you are willing to spend the time at that stage to get that solid foundation to then, you know, grow through the next phase.
Yeah. You inure yourself, you get accustomed to like, oh, this is okay. I'm feeling okay. This is normal. And it makes it much more comfortable. Yeah. I think if someone could find a way to teach improv virtually, I think they could make a mint, because you know, you're in California and New York, you can get it, but there's all these people that would benefit from it. In places like Lexington, Virginia, where when you think you are hearing your phone buzz, it's actually cows mooing, that would be useful.
Well, what we could do is we could get together with our friends Jennifer Ocker and Naomi Bagdonas, who've been doing comedy, and we'll all get together and start the virtual improv movement for corporations.
Well, there you go. I think that aren't they doing that already?
They might be, but I think that their focus is not necessarily on pure improvisational comedy, although they do touch on that some. We'd have to go back and check it out.
Yeah, that'd be fun. They're such delights.
Yes, I had them as guests on when they launched their book as well, which was a lot of fun. So I have a couple of lightning round questions, and then I'll give you a chance to put a button on whatever you like at the end. And the lightning round questions are questions I love to ask people because I think they give us valuable information for the audience as well. Mm-hmm. The first lightning round question is, what is a great book, not by you or me, that you've read recently that you'd recommend?
Two that I will suggest. One is I really loved Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. It was fantastic. Another one that I read, I read so many books.
They just send them to us, so it's hard to avoid it.
I know. Another book that I read, not super, super recently, but in the last couple of months, was Backable by Sunil Gupta, which I thought was excellent. Have you read that one?
I haven't had a chance to yet, but now, thanks to your recommendation, I and the other listeners will have a chance to check it out.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about it, and this is why I think the reason I'm remembering it, it's very well written. But he talked about the idea is if you don't believe in your ideas, no one else will. And I had this experience probably about 6 months ago as we were talking to some people about our technology tool for the growth curve. And after we got off the phone, my business partner said, "Do you not believe in this?" And I realized that I was pulling back because
you were hedging. You were like
hedging because I was afraid of being rejected. She's like, "Do you believe in this or not?" And when I read that book, it was just really a powerful thing of do I believe this? And if I do, then I just need to be willing to commit and know that some people might not agree, but that's irrelevant.
No, that is fantastic. And so that's Backable by
Sunil Gupta.
Sunil Gupta. Wonderful. And then my final lightning round question, and then I'll let you conclude. So obviously we're in the middle of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. When it feels like it will be safe, goodness only knows, it's it's taken longer than I would have expected. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we're more resilient than we ever could have imagined. But where is a place that you really want to visit when this is done?
I really want to go to Israel.
I
would like to go to Israel.
Have you ever been before?
I haven't.
Oh, perfect opportunity.
Have you been?
I have not, but I will note Israel is very heavily vaccinated. So if you're going to travel anywhere right now, Israel's probably a good choice.
Yeah, I'd really like to go there.
And visit the various historical sites and also just take in, again, it's the startup nation, right? A wildly entrepreneurial culture.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the entrepreneurial culture, but the primary reason I would want to go is because of, for religious reasons, is I'm just fascinated by just the Judeo-Christian history. It's just, I'm a Christian and I just think it's really, I'd like to go there.
Absolutely. Thousands and thousands of years of history, all encapsulated. And again, we're Americans. And so we're used to, I'm even as a native Californian, you as someone who grew up in California, it's like, something's 100 years old. Wow, that's ancient.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's make sure that folks know where to find you. So we've talked about smart growth, but remind them where they can get smart growth.
Yeah. So I love how you like set me up for the commercial. You can buy Smart Growth on Amazon.com or any of your local bookstores, which I really want to support local bookstores. And I also have a podcast, the Disrupt Yourself podcast. Chris has been a guest where we spoke about blitzscaling and started to compare the S curves. And if you want to reach out to me more directly, you can email me at wj@whitneyjohnson.com. I do answer all my emails, though I am sometimes slow.
And if they want to keep track of you and all the amazing things you're doing, they can go to whitneyjohnson.com. And that's Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, because every once in a while, there's people who spell it without the H.
Yeah, that's correct.
Fantastic. Well, Whitney, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. I cannot thank you enough for coming on. And for all of you who are listening, I hope you go out there and pick up your copy of Smart Growth. I know I have, and I've been reading it. I haven't finished it yet, but it is a fantastic book already, and I encourage you all to get it. And I look forward to having you join me again with another fantastic guest in the near future. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Yeh, and on behalf of Whitney Johnson, this has been the Chris Yeh Podcast.